Okay. Good morning. This is the Education Subcommittee of Ways and Means. It is June the 20th, and it is Tuesday, and we're here today to hold public hearings on House Bill 2998, House Bill 2729, and Senate Bill 13. So we'll open a public hearing on House Bill 2998. Introduce it?
Sure, Mr. Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 2998 requires the Higher Education Coordinating Commission to regularly convene community college and public university representatives to facilitate establishment of foundational curricula, determine major courses of study for which unified statewide agreements will be established, and develop those agreements. The bill does have a fiscal impact to the Higher Education Coordinating position. Coordinating Commission for two positions, 1.0 FTE, a total of $201,135 in the 17-19 biennium, and some potential costs that have been identified by public universities and community colleges in the last paragraph of the fiscal impact statement.
Thank you very much, Representative Reardon, Representative Johnson. Welcome to our committee.
Do you want to just do the general? Is yours more general or specific?
It's general.
Why don't you do that and I'll
go. Okay. Co-Chair Monroe, Co-Chair Smith Warner, members of the committee, it's really a pleasure to be here this morning. My name is Jeff Reardon, and I'm State Representative for House District 48. And District 48 includes parts of Southeast Portland, Happy Valley, Clackamas, and Milwaukee. I'm here in front of this committee today in support of House Bill 2998. This was a House Higher Ed and Workforce Development Committee bill. Came together after discussions about how in 2017 we still do not have a credit alignment between community colleges and universities. It isn't just an inconvenience issue for students. This is an affordability issue. And some people who are looking for a four-year degree will start taking their prerequisites at community college rather than spending more money for 4 years at university. And it's a cheaper alternative to achieve the same degree. However, there's not a clear statewide credit pathway from community colleges to universities. It is not unusual to find that classes taken at a community college do not necessarily count toward degree at a university. It kind of shocked me when I learned that. On average, transfer students graduate having earned 211 credits compared to non-transfer students, 201 credits. So moreover, 63% of transfer students enter universities with fewer credits than they had earned at community colleges, and 35% lose more than one term of coursework. That's expensive. That's a lot of money to spend on excess credits, and it is the opposite of affordable. Here we are having to raise tuition for students. Mm. We are requiring them to buy expensive books and to pay fees on nearly everything. We need to find every way possible to reduce the cost of higher education for students, and this is one way to do it. We've been talking about alignment for the last 30 years. It's time to stop talking about it and finally do something. My committee made it a top priority. I would say Rep. Wisnett, Rep. Johnson, and myself, we pretty much just locked arms and said this is going to happen this session. And I feel that the fiscal impact is modest. That does not mean I'm not aware of the difficult decisions that you make and must make every day with our pressing deficit. But I do think it is fair to do this for our students, and the least we can do in these hard times. I have no doubt we will save students millions of dollars for the amount of money that you're spending. So thank you for your time.
Thank you. Representative Johnson.
Thank you, co-chairs, committee members. For the record, Mark Johnson from House District 52. And I would just want to thank the committee chair here, Rep. Reardon, who I think provided a really good platform in the committee this session. This is my fourth term on House Higher Ed. I'm the longest serving member on House Higher Ed, even longer than our esteemed colleague from down south here.
The subcommittee representative.
But, and as he said, you know, we've been on the committee long enough, and I'm sure Senator Roland would second that, you know, you just hear these reoccurring issues like this isn't working, and we just resolved to this session to get this done. And, you know, the stars align sometimes, and the colleges and the universities, I think, also were in that mode, and the HEC played a real supporting role. So let me just give you an overview of actually what the bill does. And first of all, we did create a work group that went on for about a period of a couple of months during session to try to hash this thing out. We had the HEC involved, the public universities, community colleges. We had faculty there, the inter-faculty from the University Senate participated. And this House Bill 2998 is intended to create a path for students to begin at community college and to knowably transfer into a four-year public institution. So currently, you've probably heard there's an Oregon transfer module, right? It's been around for quite some time, and that was intended to be a recognized bucket of credits, if you will, that could be transferred from one institution to the next. The problem is, okay? And some institutions have very effective transfer module agreements between them, maybe between a regional college or a community college and a regional university in that area, but it doesn't work system-wide very well. So what we have done now is that we've put once it passed out as committee, some teeth and some framework that will be knowable, predictable, and it's something students can count on. So it's all going to begin with a foundational curricula. We're not going to talk about a transfer module anymore. We're going to call this a foundational curricula that will be made up of at least 30 credits, okay, where the universities and colleges will get together and decide, this is a universally knowable, transferable bucket of credits that will count in any major degree pathway. If you get these credits at a community college, they will transfer on with you to your next step. If it's if the associate's degree is it'll count. If you go into university, they'll be counted there as well. They will have unified transfer agreements between the colleges and universities to make this happen. A transfer agreement will be separate and unique for each degree pathway. So once we identify this foundational curricula, that's step one. Step two then is to identify the most in demand or the most likely to be transferred degree pathways and to create a pathway from the beginning, day one at a community college, on to completion at a university in each of these degree pathways. They're going to begin with the top, they're going to be in a three in the first year. Add another one each year going forward after that. So again, it's going to be a convening process of universities and colleges coming together to identify what are those credits that are necessary. We all going to agree, the students, if it's going to be an accounting major or a business major or whatever, if you start at Chemeketa, you can get your degree at OSU. They're going to know that progression of credits all the way through. So and they'll be identifying I'm sure there's folks behind us that'll talk about this, but there are in certain majors degree points that are different than at the end of, say, you get your associates or you get your 90 credits. It could be earlier. It could be later, but whatever. But the point is that will all be identified as they hash out these degree pathways. So the idea now is the students will be able to transfer from a community college into a public university as a junior or a comparable status for majors with an optional transfer point in their major. This ensures that they are on the same track as students who began at the university. So the timeline again looks like this. The foundational curriculum will be in place by the fall of 2018. That's that universal bucket of credits. The first unified transfer agreement will be established by December 1st of 2018. The second will be by April 1st of 2019. The third by December 1st of 2019. And then three transfer agreements per year going forward beginning in January 2020. Pretty significant stuff. So the HEC will be the convener of this whole process. They will be bringing the colleges, universities together to get this worked out. Additional elements are there'll be an additional emphasis on community colleges providing information, helping students identify a major prior to completing 45 credits. Again, that's a big part of it, helping these community college students identify earlier where they're, and this aligns with the work that they're doing on guided pathways. This will be a really great alignment with that work that's already in place, and help to ensure that students who are using these transfer agreements and get on a pathway through the coursework to count as early as possible. So the last thing I'll sum up with is that when you combine this policy that we have in this transfer that we're working on now with the Oregon Promise, we can now tell high school students that you can have an affordable pathway to credit acquisition to a degree, frankly, and know that the credits that you acquire are going to be usable, and we're going to be, as much as we can, eliminate those empty credits that just don't do anybody any good. So I can't explain why the stars aligned this session, but they have, and I'm really excited about, you know, again, where we're going, and I think together, with the Oregon Promise, with this policy, I really think Oregon has a chance to nationally, I think, be an example for how we can help students have affordable, quantifiable degree pathways. So with that, we're happy to take any questions.
Questions? Senator Roblin.
Yeah, just a statement. I'm really pleased that you got there, and I'm pleased that you have a pathway to get more. because those are important. And coming from another state in Washington going to a community college and getting my associate's degree and knowing when I went to the University of Washington, every single credit transfer was really nice. And I was a science major. And so all my science classes I took at the community college transferred. In fact, they tried to give me more credits than I'd earned. Because one of the classes at the community college didn't have the associate, it had a lab, but it didn't have an associated credit for the lab that the university had. So they were willing to, and I said, it didn't work. I mean, I didn't get the extra more than I had actually earned, but every credit transferred, and it was this easy transition. I knew where I was going to go. And then I chose to change majors, so I had to spend a little bit more time, but that's a choice that kids make all the time, you know, from science to math to educate, whatever. And those do have other requirements that you're going to have to do. But the fact that all those credits, those 90 credits transferred, made decisions at the university so much better. And I hope we can get there. I think your path will do that. It does make for students deciding a pathway a little sooner than I think is oftentimes their choice. Sure. But if they stay in that path, a lot of it, I think, when they get to the university, will transfer across mm-hmm. little places.
Mm-hmm.
But just about every major requires the science classes and math classes. And I mean, I think you could go more than 30 pretty much in that base.
And they may, Senator. It's at least 30. Could be
okay,
more.
That's, yeah. And I really do appreciate the work that was done. Because we do need to finish this up. It's been my whole career.
Yep.
Madam Co-Chair.
Thank you, Mr. Co-Chair. Thank you both, and thank you, Representative Wisnett, for your work on this. I just wanted to reinforce the whole, I think this is a great idea. I particularly like the timelines in it, because indeed, as you've all discussed, it has been, every time I read this, I'm like, haven't we already done this? Because you think that we have. And my one question is just when you talk about the three per year, do you mean it'll be three majors per year that you determine, okay, this one, these are the credits, this will go? Okay, I missed at the beginning whether it was classes or full-on majors.
Major pathway.
Great.
Representative. Yep.
Great. Thank you.
And just to sum up, you know, hats off to the colleges, universities, and the HEC, I think, for coming together here, too. They've all played a key role. And as you well know, sometimes they don't always see eye to eye on things. There's a little intramural, you know, rivalry there. But I think collectively, I think folks just recognize this is the time to really try it. Let's drive a stake in the ground and let's move forward united on this issue.
Representative Wisner.
Thank you, Mr. Co-Chair. Very briefly, Representative Reardon, thank you for your leadership. Representative Johnson, thank you for all your time and effort, but it really goes to his legislative assistant. She did all the work. But
agreed. Agreed.
And I think having Dana Richardson work, bringing us together, because we said not, as Chair Reardon said, today, let's do it today, not tomorrow, keep working and working on this. So thank you very much. I think we can all be proud of as Oregon legislators. This.
Okay, additional questions?
Just one last comment. I'd really like to thank Representative Johnson and his staff for just taking ownership of this. And my leadership style is pretty much empower others to go out and solve problems. And they certainly have done this, and I really appreciate it. It's what makes a good team.
And all I can say is it's about time. And the reason that the stars align is because there are good people in the House and the Senate
right.
who have forced them to align. And you two are the lead of that gang. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Okay. Shall I put them last? Okay. Lisa Avery from Portland Community College and Nikki Aman from the Students Association. Welcome, ladies.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Sure. Okay, good excuse me, good morning. Chair Smith, Warner, and Monroe, my name is Lisa Avery. For the record, I am the campus president at Portland Community College, Sylvania campus, and I'm here today to testify in support of House Bill 2998. Our goal, I think, could be restated that we'd like all students to have Senator Roblin's experience when he went to UW and all of his credits went with him. Simply put, it's long overdue, and that's the goal of the President's Association here. A little bit of background is that the bill started when the Oregon Community College Association and the Oregon President's Council bill for the community colleges identified this deep need in Oregon that students were not retaining enough of their credits at transfer, as has already been mentioned this morning. We need to change that so we can improve graduation rates at the colleges and universities and get our students out working, earning middle-class family wage jobs. It's important to note that this is a top priority of the President's Association this year, and that the community colleges and public universities both support the bill, and it was a product of a lot of collaboration and detail work throughout the session. It's, again, long overdue, and it mandates that the community colleges and universities convene faculty groups to develop similar learning outcomes for the courses. And I do want to state that this doesn't mean they have to be the same course, but rather that the learning outcomes are the same, so guaranteeing students the same results, and that the courses transfer with them, which we see as a key affordability issue for our students. We don't want students paying for courses twice, nor the taxpayers. So it's very important for us in terms of efficiencies. The universities have some differentiation in their courses, but that typically happens at the upper level, junior and senior year. The first 2 years of the college and university experience should have the same learning outcomes, and we believe that this bill is a great way to get us there. We don't want students, as they often unfortunately have to do right now, to retake courses in their major that they've already completed and paid for. So we want to, again, improve efficiency and improve their access to credit transfer, which we do see, again, as affordability. It's ongoing work. It's our top priority for the session, and our president colleagues have committed to absorbing the cost at the colleges for this. We think that the costs are minor, and we're happy to encumber those to help the bill proceed. So, again, we thank you for your consideration and support of this legislation.
Thank you very much.
Good morning, everyone. My name is Nikki Amon. I'm from the Oregon Student Association, and I'm a current student at Oregon State University. I'm here to talk about House Bill 2998, and I also wanted to start off by thanking Representative Winsnett and Johnson and Reardon for all of their work on this. This is an extremely important issue to students, obviously. As has been said already, there's a lot of things lost in transfer. I myself am a transfer student from Lynn Benton Community College to Oregon State, and I was extremely lucky in my transfer because, like Representative Johnson said, it's an easier transfer if you're going from a regional community college to a regional university. So it's very, it's a lot easier. There's a lot more in place to support you in that transition. So I was extremely lucky, but I know a lot of people, a lot of fellow students of mine, and a lot of people part of the Oregon Student Association who did not have, that is not their reality. A lot of things include, a lot of issues that are included with this problem is that students do have to often pay twice for credits, or maybe even the credits that they have received in community college aren't going towards the things that they want, and they're not being supported adequately. So the idea that there could be people in place with this bill to assist in that transition is a wonderful thought, and I really hope that this becomes a reality because it's definitely needed. I think it's important that this bill be fully funded, even though there is a fiscal attached. It is extremely necessary and important to students because the money that isn't spent on making this better is going to come out of students' pockets towards credits. So I want to close on the fact that this is a really, really wonderful bill, and the Oregon Student Association fully supports this and hopes that you will too. Thank you so much.
Thank you. I've praised Lynn Benton and their relationship with Oregon State many times. And so you're very fortunate that that's your path. But it ought to be true all over the state, and it ought to be true between all of our community colleges and all of our universities. And that's the purpose of this bill, is to get it there. So thank you very much. Are there questions for the witnesses? Representative Wisnett.
Thank you, Mr. Co-Chair. I'm sorry, Lisa.
Yes.
Representative Johnson made a comment about that this is going to be in a law versus a rules. Do you think that's more effective with the President's Council and the universities and working? That it be in statute versus rules?
Representative Wisnett and co-chairs, I think that we think that this, the stringent timeline that's laid out here and the deliverables back to the committee and the people will be helpful in making sure that we're all held accountable to help students succeed in this way.
Thank you.
diplomatic, very diplomatic. Any other questions for these witnesses? Thank you, ladies. Thank you very much. Okay, Ben and Kyle from Heck, come on down.
Good morning, Mr. Chair, Co-Chair, members. For the record, Ben Cannon, Executive Director of the Oregon Higher Education Coordinating Commission, and joined by our Legislative Director, Kyle Thomas. I'll just begin by adding my appreciation for the work of the House Higher Ed and Workforce Committee, as well as the universities and colleges, for the collaborative process that resulted in this bill. This is a very significant piece of policy, and as has been alluded to previously, there have been ongoing efforts by the legislature to get at this issue since at least the late 1980s, if not longer. We've got a pretty long legislative history and quite a bit of statute already on this issue. This is different, and this is significant. For a few reasons, it embeds a truly collaborative process, faculty-led process, to develop these pathways. It also embeds teeth. This bill requires this work to be done statutorily. And with your support, this would also provide modest funding to ensure that the work can be done on the timeline that's described and done effectively. What we've brought is an abbreviated version of a presentation that we provided to the House Higher Education and Workforce Committee that really attempts to get at what the problem is. And then you have, you know, one, we think, pretty important solution for it. I'm not going to necessarily spend time on every slide here. There are, I think, about 10. There's a little bit of repetition. But we did want to make sure you understood this is more than an anecdotal issue. This is a real, and we have data here to describe the fact of the issue that faces students related to transfer today. Just in terms of the HECS role, and we would, if the bill becomes law, play a convening and supporting role in the work that the colleges and universities would do to create these pathways. And I just note this from our strategic plan, this notion of coordinating a coordinating commission, creating more simpler, effective pathways for students, including between community colleges and universities, is central to our commission's, we think, reasons for existence, and certainly our commission-identified strategic plan. So just a little bit of the data, and most of this is drawn from national studies, but we have some Oregon-specific pieces from it. According to one, 81% of community college students intend to transfer and earn a bachelor's degree or higher. Yet in Oregon, only 11% are successful in doing so within 6 years. So that gives you a sense of some of the types of challenges, or the fact that students at community colleges face challenges and barriers in their attempt to transfer. Those community college beginning students, the ones who many of whom intend to transfer, are more likely to be underrepresented students in higher education because of the nature of community colleges, the lower cost option, the types of populations that they typically serve. And as a result, we think this emphasis on transfer is particularly important. So the problem, and I have some data here. Let's just focus on Oregon and Washington. So the first column, this community college transfer out rate. So these are Oregon students at community colleges, 29% of whom transfer to a four-year university. But then when you move to the right-hand column, only 38% of those students complete a bachelor's degree within the time period described, within the total of 6 years of education. And you can see how that compares. And just look at Washington, where actually the transfer rate is a little bit lower, 26%, but quite a bit higher success rate for those students, nearly half, still not great, but nearly half of those students earning a bachelor's degree within 6 years. When we focus on students who transfer to public institutions specifically, so that bachelor's degree success rate that I noted, the 38% for Oregon, that was transferring to any public or private institution. When we look at public institutions specifically, it's close, but actually a little lower, 35% compared with 55%. So again, a Washington student who transfers from a community college into a public university has a 55% success rate. Again, not great, but a whole lot better than the 35% that we experience in Oregon. Well, what does this have to do with the issues addressed in the bill? And I'll skip through this. This is actually another view of transfer student success rates. The 62.4% looks quite a bit better here. This is bachelor degree earning students. These are students, though, who transferred with a significant number of credits. So we've called them sort of robust transfer students. Okay, so what does this have to do with the bill? Well, this is the issue of credit loss. So this slide describes, compares students who originated at the university, the four-year university, that's non-transfer students in the green bars, with transfer students in the red bar. And if you focus just on the left-hand side of this slide, you'll notice, and this was cited earlier by one of the representatives, that transfer students, on average, graduate with 10 more credits, 211, versus the non-transfer students, the 201. So that 10 credit, those are 10 additional credits that those transfer students have paid for. Now, there can be a lot of reasons for this, but it is symptomatic of the challenge that transfer students face and the sort of lack of efficient or the less efficient pathways to degree. On the right-hand side, this is a little bit confusing, but it should not be surprising that transfer students earn fewer credits at their university. That's all that's expressed by on the right-hand side. But you'll note that it's 105. It's a significant number of credits earned at the university by transfer students. This is perhaps even more compelling in terms of credit loss, and this comes from our analysis of student-level data. So we've identified that 63% of transfer students essentially lose credit. They, when they transfer to the university in Oregon, their transcripts have fewer credits than they transfer credits than they earned at the community college. So that we would, as a starting point, and the bill requires some additional analysis on this, but we would at the outset suggest that about two-thirds of Oregon students, Oregon transfer students, lose credits. That means they earned them at the community college, but they're not successfully transferred to the university at the outset. And 35% of transfer students, that amount is more than 15 credits. So that's a pretty significant loss between community colleges and universities. Again, the bill requires more analysis of this credit loss issue, clearer and tighter definitions, and reporting back to the legislature with more precision around this data. Finally, just on the student view, and this comes from a Oregon report, barriers reported, and glad we had a student here today, but barriers that include inadequate advising, perceived lack of support services, misunderstanding financial aid, lack of coordinated, meaningful, and articulate, accurate information about transfer agreements. Again, an important bill, a significant issue, a primary point of concern for the legislature historically, for the Higher Education Coordinating Commission today, and we appreciate the committee's interest and hopefully support.
Thank you, Mr. Cannon.
Senator Monroe, I have actually nothing to add. I'm just here to assist with answering
questions.
You're
just supporting the big guy. Representative Wisnett.
Thank you, Mr. Co-Chair. All you have to do is sharpen your pencil, call this whole direction to you. You know, be sure that pencil's sharp and have an eraser on it. Get the cost down.
Additional questions for the witnesses? Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Is there anybody else that didn't get to sign up that wanted to testify on House Bill 2998? If not, we will close the public hearing on 2998 and open a public hearing on House Bill 2729.
Mr. Co-Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 2729 directs the Higher Education Coordinating Commission to collaborate with public universities and community colleges to increase the number of open educational resources, or OERs, which are freely accessible teaching, learning, and research resources such as textbooks, videos, and images. The bill has a blank general fund appropriation to the HEC in the 2017-19 biennium, and there are an A2 and A3 proposed amendments on OLIS for the committee's consideration.
Good morning, Co-Chair Monroe, Co-Chair
Representative Weirden. Oh,
sorry, I got so excited here just to be back. It seemed like I was just here. Co-Chair Monroe, Co-Chair Smith-Warner, and members of the committee, I'm still Jeff Reardon, State Representative for District 48. And I have no prepared testimony on this particular bill. I just want to reinforce that, you know, we anticipated as a committee that, you know, it's unlikely that we'll be have adequate resources to try to keep tuition down. So in lieu of that, what could we do to promote affordability? And you just heard about House Bill 2998. I think that's going to be a giant step in helping with that. But to the same degree, I think the open educational resources will really help keep costs down. And this would be just to continue what we started in 2015 and try to address the issue of, you know, $300, $400, $500 textbooks. How can we get those to students for zero to maybe $30? So that's what this program's about. And there's been a lot of success in other states doing that. We have want to continue this effort. And Rep. Wisnett has been the driving force behind this particular effort. And so he'll provide you with the details.
And Representative Wisnett.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Honorable committee members, for the record, I'm Gene Wisnett, State Representative, House District 53. Thank the chair for making this one of the priority bills for the committee. The Open Education Resources Program, OER, which is free online textbook, basically, was created by House Bill 2871 in the 2015 session. And the students are going to speak to, I hope, about how they think this is real important. It's helped them, their pocketbook, and their parents in their pocketbook. Since the program was created, the program that we created by 2871 actually ends 30th of June. But that program was successful. Students have been using it. Part of the bill required them to advertise in their material that this is textbooks are online or free. So that was cool. And they estimate about 2.1 million savings. And we spent authurized $700,000 to do this. And what happened is we issued grants, and it was a real complicated situation to put together academia people to agree that those textbooks online that were free were better than some that cost a couple hundred bucks or whatever. Treasurer Tobias Reed, who chaired the committee before Jeff, during the interim says, Gene, the program, we didn't have the bill ends. It doesn't have a continuation. And he thought how important it was for the students and their pocketbook to do this. So with Jeff's leadership, then we created a bill, worked hard with the HEC, a lot of work, real hard, a lot of hours spent on this. But everyone agrees it was a good thing. We wanted to continue how to continue it. And we came up with the House Bill 2729. I'll let Mr. Thomas can maybe talk about the two amendments. There was something about numbers. There's a technical change on them, or the staff can talk about it. But committee members, I think it's real important. I think we're asking about $700,000 to continue the program. That's what the bill does, continues the program. We won't create 15 new textbooks, but we want to continue to create as many as we can. This is a good bill. I really urge you to pass this bill and fund it at the level necessary. In my time in the building, I won't argue with Representative Johnson on who on the committee, but we've had good chair leadership on that committee. And I think that committee, there was some doubt about whether that committee was going to exist this session. But I hope leadership looks and sees this committee is the one that gave us Oregon Promise. This is the committee that now hopefully is going to give you HB 2998 to help students and also HB 2729A to help bring down textbooks. But I think with all this legislation that we produced to try to control costs and produce affordable degrees we can be proud of. The parents and students are going to be happy, and we should be proud of it. Thank you.
Thank you. Questions of the witnesses? Senator Roblin.
Are we encouraging the textbooks we get online to be updated so that they stay current and all of that with regard to the same thing? And the second part of the question is, does it have an emergency clause? Because it certainly should if it's going to.
Yeah. Well, I got the bill. Let's see what the bill says. We're supposed to remove those.
I don't want them over. I mean, if the other one sunsets, you probably don't want it removed. So,
Thank you, Mr. Representative Roblin. It does have an emergency clause.
And that's
a key point, because if, the person in that position is we have enough money to pay her for the continuity of replacing. She may not be seeking the permanent position, but it does go in emergency, so we can keep it going.
And with respect to the updating, does it do that?
Thank you, Mr. Co-Chair, Representative Roblin. The way the process works is the professor makes that decision.
Okay,
if he wants to update it, and that's what we're when we I attended several of the meetings. I didn't attend all the meetings when we got into the details, but we're trying to select books that we can alter, change, update, or whatever. That was one of the criteria in judging which ones we went with. And I was not participating in the details when the professors were arguing about that stuff. But they produced is your staff summary, very good staff summary. Again, came up with, 15 that we were required to have. We issue grants and they go out. But, yes, they can be. The professor decides if he doesn't want that next time, then he goes to another one.
Go ahead.
And one follow-up. As we move forward with 2998 and we identify 30 courses, that might be a place to go, or 30 credits, that might be a place to go at the very beginning with respect to getting new textbooks.
Yeah, Mr. Co-Chair, Representative Roblin, the courses that were agreed to are mostly undergrad, the lower level for community college. We didn't really get into the upper levels. But what was amazing, I think, is I did participate in some of the discussion. Like one textbook would actually satisfy like algebra, 1, 2, and 3 algebra.
Right.
So you're getting the same, saving 3 years of textbook in algebra for this. So it's a great program. And I was going to mention, I don't know if you've been in a library recently, but I get to experience this with my grandson when I'm visiting. And you go to the library now, you don't get a book. He takes his what is the computer they take in, and they download the book so on the computer. So this is the future, and I'm glad that Oregon's taken following that and going to use that technology to help our students in higher education.
Anything else for the witnesses? Thank you.
Thank you.
Okay, Tabitha Pitzer and Teresa Wolf. Welcome.
Hello. Hello, Chair Smith Warner, Chair Monroe, and members of the committee. My name is Tabitha Pitzer. I am a third-year student at Oregon State, and I'm involved with the Oregon Student Association. Before I begin, I really want to give a big, sincere thank you to Representative Wisnett for truly being a champion with OERs. It's been your top priority in students in higher education. Really appreciate you and the work you've put in towards this. But I've testified about cost of funding and all that to make higher education more affordable many times in college. But there's another cost that continues to make obtaining a degree very difficult, and that's the cost of textbooks. At Oregon State, it is estimated that the average student spends around $2,000 on textbook a year, and on average, I spend around $300 on textbooks a term, and often choose not to purchase textbooks if possible. However, there are some textbooks or interactive homework programs that are almost impossible to get around, no matter how resourceful you get. According to the Bureau of Labor Statistics, textbook costs have increased 1,041% since 1977. That's over 3 times the cost of inflation, and students are feeling the burden of this increased cost. Due to the high cost of textbooks, it's not uncommon for the cost of course materials to be too great to be fully covered by financial aid, moving to an out-of-pocket cost that must be paid in order to succeed in class. And this has had real effects on students' lives. During the first 2 weeks of every term, our campus food bank sees an increase in students seeking food aid, showing that students are having to make the choice of either paying for textbooks or food. And 2 years ago, the Oregon Student Association surveyed over 15,000 students across the state, and we found that textbook affordability was their second highest concern, right behind tuition affordability. I'm actively involved in conversations at OSU regarding the cost of textbooks, and I previously sat on the HEC committee for House Bill 2871 in 2015, and I know of one sustainable solution to this growing problem: open education resources. OERs can substantially reduce the cost of course materials for students. There are thousands of materials out there waiting to be revised and adapted to fit the needs of faculty members and to be implemented into their courses. The most compelling way to convince faculty to adopt OERs is to provide compensation for their time through grants funded by bills like House Bill 2729. A professor friend of mine created an OER for biochemistry in 2012. That textbook has been downloaded almost 200,000 times and has saved students over $8 million in the United States and $40 million globally. OERs produced with funds from House Bill 2729 could have the same success. Please support House Bill 2729 with $700,000 of funding. With a continuously increasing cost of tuition and cost of living, students need help making education affordable and accessible in any way possible. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Go ahead.
thank you. Co-chairs Monroe, Smith, Warner, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Teresa Wolf. I am at the HEC, and I am an education policy specialist hired out of House Bill 2871 to work on OER. So I just would like to talk a little bit about following up with what Representative Wisnett said, that OER are open educational resources, and the emphasis on these are that they're freely available materials, meaning that they're available to the public, and that includes professors, faculty, staff, for adaption, creation, modification. So this differentiates them from textbooks in that they're not copyrightable. They can be, but a true OER is not copyrightable. It is available to freely modify and can be used in place of a textbook. And as the LFO pointed out in the definition, that they do include things beyond a textbook. They can be images, they can be podcasts, they can be videos. The benefits of OER are that they replace the high cost of textbooks, and it serves as just one means of addressing affordability for students. So, for example, the OER program from HB 2871 generated OER for 14 high enrollment courses that are transferable between community colleges and universities, and this generated an estimated annual savings of $2.6 million for students annually. In modeling elements after, so what are the benefits of an OER and OER initiative? In modeling elements after other states, a statewide OER program for Oregon could include, but it's not limited to, increasing OER collaborations across the state between institutions of higher ed, developing methods to best put OER into the hands of students, assisting faculty in adopting, creating, storing OER materials, and then ensuring the progress from HB 2871 is not lost. In terms of HB 2729, it's HEC's recommendation that monies appropriated for this bill fund the work of an OER advisory group, which would include salary for an institutional OER coordinator, monies for faculty release time to participate in an advisory group, and to fund other considerations such as an OER repository and an annual OER symposium. No more than $150,000 would be allotted for OER grants or awards, but this could also include training and workshops for higher education participants. Thank you, and I'd like to open it up for questions.
Questions?
That's good.
Mr. Kutcher.
Yes, Representative Wisnett.
Our grants were $15,000, but this doesn't limit one to develop the test.
No, it does not.
It doesn't limit that. If they could, you have to go higher than that to get it. It might have to get more complicated than as we go up in the numbers of the textbooks.
And we are hopeful that this bill and the previous one will both be given the authority to work them in a few days, and so we'll be seeing them again. I remember when I was a college student a couple of years ago in the early 1960s, and I decried the cost of textbooks, and of course they weren't near as expensive as they are today. And I remember I used to buy used textbooks from the bookstore for two-thirds of the cost of new ones, and then when I got done I could sell them back to the bookstore for half of what I paid for them. And that was interesting, and I was complaining, my father was a college professor, I was complaining about the cost of textbooks, and he came down on me like ugly on ape, I'll tell you, because he said, when I was in college, which he went to college during the Depression, said, when I was in college I couldn't afford to buy textbooks. I had to go to the library and read the textbook that was in the library. You should be blessed that you can afford to buy your textbooks. So, textbooks are an important part of an education, certainly. Thank you, ladies. Appreciate you coming. Hopefully, we'll get the okay. Representative Smith Warner and I both have prioritized these two bills. Is there anybody else that wanted to be heard on 2729? That didn't get a chance to sign up? If not, we'll close the public hearing on 2729 and we will open a public hearing on Senate Bill 13, And are you doing this one?
That'll be Doug. He'll be in just a moment, Mr. Co-Chair. But in the meantime, Senate Bill 13 directs the Oregon Department of Education to develop a curriculum for students in kindergarten through 12th grade relating to the Native American experience in Oregon and make curriculum available to school districts and provide professional development to teachers and administrators. The bill does correspond to a policy option package number 113, Tribal History and Sovereignty Curriculum in the ODE budget, which is Senate Bill 5516.
And we have a number of people here to testify. And I think I'll start with the people that aren't in the building all the time. Dina Smith. And Ashley Oakley, why don't you come on up? And we'll start with Mr. Wilson. Doug, why don't you introduce this subject for us, and
Mr.
We'll
Chair,
hear from the witnesses.
Members, this is Senate Bill 13, this Native American curriculum in schools. The bill in front of you provides the authority to the department to set up the curriculum. The governor's budget had $2 million in for this, $200,000 for the agency for curriculum development, and then the remaining $1.8 were for grants to the nine tribal nations. And I'm sure someone else can explain it much better than I can.
Thank you very much. Okay, Smith.
Did you want to go first?
Welcome.
Yeah, if you don't mind, I would like to go first.
Okay.
Yeah, thank you. Good morning, co-chairs Monroe and Smith Warner, members of the committee. I would first like to acknowledge the nine sovereign nations of Oregon and a lot of the work that has already been done so far on this. Thank you so much for your time today. For the record, my name is Ashley Oakley, and I evaluate Head Start and early Head Start programs at the Native American Youth and Family Center. At this time, we know our budgets are strained. We need to make smart investments that improve the educational outcomes of our future civic leaders. Senate Bill 13 is a smart investment because there's been systematic miseducation, and we require macro-level intervention. Our teachers are overworked, and this bill has ready-made curriculum and training that is provided to help teachers. We already have hundreds of Native volunteers across the state that are volunteering and have been volunteering their time to educate and inform public institutions like schools, preschools, DHS, and so many other institutions. I had one volunteer who worked in his child's school tell me, "My son and I are tribal members, and I volunteer my time to educate his classmates about our tribe. These children and some of their parents think that we don't exist, or that they don't understand where we came from." Experiences like this are really common. I hear them all the time when I interview parents about their experiences in the public schools. It's extremely traumatic for the Native community, and I don't doubt that it contributes to the extremely high dropout rate for Native American high school students. The miseducation is systematic. Even some Native people don't know the full history of the trauma within the school systems. My mother is half Mescalero Apache and a third grade teacher, and I consistently have to explain to her why a Native family might be a little bit apprehensive to get involved at her school. We need to shift our culture away from celebrating Thanksgiving in ways like Pilgrim and Indians. The tribal history is our tribal history, and this is long overdue. It's been causing a lot of problems for a lot of people that have already endured so much. I would really appreciate your support. It would be better for all of us in Oregon, everyone who calls this place home. Thank you.
Thank you. Why don't you go ahead?
Okay. My name is Deanie Smith, and I'm an enrolled member of the Confederated Tribes of Warm Springs. I'm here today as an educator for the Culture and Heritage Department for our tribes, also as a parent and a member of the Warm Springs Education Committee. As we were talking about smart investment, the Senate Bill 13 will allow for accurate accounts of events to be recorded that will help eliminate stereotypes of Native American people. The savage Indian, the drunken Indian, the stoic brave, or the mystical Indian are identities that Native people have carried for a very long time. We are human beings and unique and hold dual citizenships with tribal nations as well as the United States. We are people that are unique, resilient, and survivors that have endured assimilation, termination, and extinction. We are the first Americans of this nation. So rather than carrying these inaccurate identities, Senate Bill 13 will allow us to dispel the negative stereotypes and allow us to walk in pride rather than shame. Thank you for your time.
Thank you. Questions of these witnesses? Thank you very much, ladies. We appreciate you coming. I guess we better hear from Lindsay Capps. I understand has to leave pretty soon. And Cindy Hunt, why don't you come up with Lindsay? Oh, okay. All right. Lindsay, go ahead.
Co-Chair Monroe, Co-Chair Smith Warner, members of the committee. For the record, I'm Lindsay Capps, Chief Education Officer, and I'm here to speak in favor of Senate Bill 13 and express the governor's strong support for this legislation. I'd also like to recognize the representatives of our 9 federally recognized tribes who are here today to present with us. The strong partnership between our state government and our sovereign nations is critical in our shared commitment to our American Indian Alaska Native students in Oregon. This legislation today is sort of the next step in implementing the state's American Indian Alaska Native State Plan. It began certainly with the establishment of capacity and resources within the Oregon Department of Education to provide not only an Indian education advisor within the department, but also an education specialist that can be supportive of schools and tribal governments across the state. And it was also implemented through the legislature's support for the Tribal Attendance Pilot Project, which is seeing great success across the state. This is really the next step in that process to help us further address challenges that we know exist within our educational system in our serving of American Indian students. And while there are promising efforts underway, like our TAP project, in many of our schools and communities, there's really an untapped opportunity for us to better engage and support Native students and their families. And implementing Native curriculum that is developed in collaboration with our federally recognized tribes is an opportunity for us to better connect students in their learning to their culture and identity, and it benefits all Oregon students to know the true and full Oregon story. This legislation will also help us in that regard, help our schools make greater strides in keeping Oregon students engaged and on track. So with that, I would like to commend your attention to this legislation and encourage your passage and support of this so that we can continue to make progress in implementing our state plan for our Native students.
Thank you very much. Go ahead, identify yourself and let's hear from your testimony.
Naika Chawashliu Lamkayat. Naika Ichliu Bushnam Angi Valerie Switzler. Thank you. Co-chairs and members of the committee. My name is Valerie Switzler, and I'm a member of the Confederated Tribes of Warm Springs. I'm also a tribal council representative, a culture and heritage manager, and a grandma. So, you know, I'm very proud of my 10 grandchildren. And I just want to thank you for allowing me to come and visit with you about Senate Bill 13. This bill will allow for the tribes to generate authentic curriculum, meaningful, and to our tribes, to our 9 tribes here in Oregon. It's based on each of our historical accounts in our tribe. Today, you search the web and you'll find websites that have, there are six federally recognized tribes. You'll find that there, you know, that there are 173 tribes here in Oregon. And, you know, it, and so there is so much out there that needs to be corrected and for the benefit of those that originated from this homeland. The tribes will develop their stories and replace the stereotypes, as was mentioned before, of those that are negative to our people, and will give our people some strength. And so we don't live in the past. We live, you know, our people have come through such tragic histories that, you know, from the, many of you heard of the Trail of Tears. We each have a Trail of Tears here in the Nine Tribes, where we were displaced from the Columbia River and moved to Central Oregon. You know, each of us have our own stories. Our, you know, one of the things I'd like to build is this notion of us being good neighbors again. At one time, the school districts reached out and asked us, can you come and tell, you know, tell us about Warm Springs? Can you come and tell us about your people? And then as the, you know, as tribal budgets got tighter, as gas got higher, as school budgets got tighter, you know, those relationships aren't there anymore. And so I'd like to, you know, bring back that notion of good neighbors and share with the people, you know, our neighbors, why Warm Springs is different from any other minority in the nation, you know. We did our due diligence, and we researched Montana and Washington that have similar bills. And we asked them, you know, about the strengths and the evidence for implementing something like this in their states. And so we asked them, if you could do it all over again, what would you do? And one of them was to attach money to the efforts that they were doing. And because without the tribes being able to write that curriculum and to implement into the into each school in Oregon, then they were, you know, or in their state, then they weren't, it didn't have any teeth. And then the teachers, they could do it, or maybe they couldn't, they wouldn't do it, you know. And so I want to help build that relationship. I want to be able to make historical accounts accurate for our peoples, for each of the nine tribes. And so thank you for your support on this, and I appreciate the time that you've given me today.
Thank you very much. We appreciate your testimony.
Thank you.
Who should we go to now?
Cindy.
Okay, Cindy. And Ms. McNulty? McNulty?
Okay, thank you. Cindy Hunt, Government and Legal Affairs Manager from the Oregon Department of Education. And I am here to testify in favor of Senate Bill 13. You've already heard about some of the reasons. I've also submitted written testimony that goes into more details about how the department would implement the bill in the background. So I won't repeat that. But to fill in a couple of things, you've heard some of the witnesses already talk about how important the history is. But the bill also talks about, in addition to history and the curriculum, current events, tribal sovereignty, the impact of tribal sovereignty and treaty rights on our current events, the government structure of the tribes. These are all things that, you know, you've heard the impact on Native students and Natives, but it's also important for all Oregonians to understand that and how those things can impact what we're doing today. So that's also included in the bill. basically, the bill would be implemented in three phases. The first phase is working with all nine tribes and the development of curriculum, and also working with a contractor around an essential understandings of curriculum that would be aligned to Oregon standards. The second phase is professional development for teachers and administrators, because one of the comments we get a lot from teachers is, I'd love to do this, but I don't know where to start. I don't know, you know, what to access, that kind of thing. So that's phase two. And then the third phase is rolling it out to school districts in the second biennium. And so that's laid out in my testimony, and I'm here to answer questions if you have those.
Representative Wisnett.
Thank you, Mr. Co-Chair. Mrs. Hunt, is there an online free course Khan Academy or something?
Representative Wisnett, I'm not familiar with all of the Khan Academy's curriculum offerings, but this is what I will tell you. A lot of times, I think when you go online and you see, you know, and I think you heard this from some of the witnesses, each tribe has a unique history. And so, you know, so when you go into some of those sort of national sorts of resources, they may focus on a particular area of the United States. For example, I grew up in Montana, and Montana's tribal history is completely different than Oregon's tribal history. And so one of the things that SPIL does is it focuses on the nine federally recognized tribes of Oregon, you know, and their history. So.
Go ahead.
Thank you, Ms. Kutcher. I agree, but and that's what we're trying to do here as part of it. But I think I would encourage the department to look into that and see if it could be used again. And as we testified in the previous bill, that if we get the, if it doesn't have a copyright, you can, you know, add to it, whatever. But it might bring down the cost.
Additional, Madam Co-Chair.
Thank you, Mr. Co-Chair. Thank you, everyone who has testified already. And Cindy, let me just—I just want to look through. Thank you for your written testimony, because that is helpful along with what you said. I just wanted to ask about, so in addition to the grants, the ODE money would help to implement and provide the professional development. Is that going to be sufficient to do professional development across the whole state?
Yeah, Co-Chair Smith Warner and Monroe, when we were developing the estimate, I don't think it will hit all teachers, but we will try to do it in the most efficient manner possible. Also, some of the nine tribes have already, I know, developed relationships with their local districts and are also providing that professional development. So the amount of money that you see there is not the entire amount of resources going into this effort. Okay. Because, for example, I just had a district yesterday tell me about where they had an opportunity to send all of their history teachers to the Siletz tribe for some professional development recently. And so those kinds of efforts are going on.
And follow up.
Go ahead.
Thank you. And can I clarify, but we're not just talking about doing this education, this curriculum, around where the tribes are. We're talking about doing it statewide.
Co-Chair Smith-Warner, you are exactly correct. It would be statewide. Okay. That's correct.
Okay. Thank you.
Okay. Representative Parrish.
So, Cindy, on the professional development side, one of the models that we've done before, and I'm not sure how you're anticipating what professional development looks like, but that I think has been effective, has been around that classroom law, civics, where we send teachers from our own districts, they go in, get that training, the next year we send people from our districts. And so that at some point, you know, we've identified who locally we think in our school districts really is that person who should get that professional development, who can carry that back, and that legislators have been a piece of that. Are you looking to maybe something similar for how we would do the professional development, or is it just kind of a random free-for-all of, you know, hey, there's this opportunity? Because sometimes people take those opportunities who may not be the most impactful person in their communities to disseminate that information, and I want to make sure if we're going to spend dollars that we really are working with districts to try to figure out, like, who is that key person who can not just then deliver that material in their own classroom, but then can roll that out to other teachers and be a really good sort of teach the teacher.
Yeah, Co-Chair Smith-Warner, Representative Parrish, you're correct. What you're describing is basically a train-the-trainer kind of a model, and we have certainly had some success with that. And the example of the district I used, you know, they had identified their history teachers to start with, but they also talked about how the tribe was willing to come in and talk to all of their teachers, you know, at a later date. So that's just one example. You know, so I
think we'll be using a variety of methods, you know, and kind of depending on the area of the state, I think it will vary because, and the particular district, because like I said, some districts have pre-established relationships with the local tribes and some do not. And so as we roll this out, I think that we will have to use different techniques, you know, depending on where we're at in the state. Yeah.
Okay. Thank you very much.
Oh, I'm sorry.
Madam Co-Chair.
Thank you. I promise this is the last question. Thank you, Mr. Co-Chair. I also just wanted to, so do any of the tribes have this curriculum already that they, whether it's because they've done it through their own cultural work and their organizations?
Yeah. Co-Chair Smith-Warner, I will have to get back to you with a complete answer, but this is what I can tell you. Because of some recent work we've been doing with the State Board around Native American mascots, I can tell you that the Saletz, Grand Ronde, and Cow Creek all have curriculum at the fourth grade right now, and I believe all have plans to expand to eighth grade and then into high school. And then what I'll have to get back to you on is a complete list, you know, with the nine tribes and where they're at. I'm is not as familiar with the other tribes.
Thank you.
Thank you. Please, go ahead.
Okay, hi. Co-Chair Monroe and Smith Warner and everyone else at the the table here. Thank you so much for having me. I'd first like to acknowledge the nine sovereign nations of Oregon and all other tribal nations who traditionally used Oregon and were here and the first people here. For the record, my name is Kalar McNulty. Yep. Yes. Yeah.
There we go.
Yeah, it's hard. It's tough. I'm actually a member of the Ohlone, Costanoan, and Esalen Nation in the Monterey Coast, California. And I'm here today as a student and as a concerned tribal member myself. So I really love this SB 13 that I've been hearing about. I really wish we had something like this in California going on right now. And I've seen firsthand, I'm a tutor, and I've tutored since I was in eighth grade, and I've seen firsthand how important this type of curriculum is to not only Native students, but all the students in the classroom, getting to learn about different sides of history, different points of view, and especially with this place-based, these place-based histories and stories are very, very important for confidence and just, you know, having that well-rounded viewpoint going in, out into the world and becoming better citizens. And then as a student in higher education, I have gotten to take classes based in different California Indian histories. And that has been healing for me as a tribal member because I've been able to understand, you know, just the nuances and how all of us are different, as was said earlier, you know, not every tribe is different. Every single tribe is different. And it's getting back to correcting this history and helping to just really heal everyone in this situation. So thank you.
Thank you. Mm-hmm. Thank you all for coming. Why don't we go to Liz Ba from the Navajo tribe and Karina Wolf. Welcome.
Yat eh buju she ya les mahi and she kia ani ni shado ojibwe bashish chin nat on at chine da she che do balagana da shnala oko akot ego e the na stan nshla. I'm speaking a language that I'm sorry, I'm trying to get settled here. Good morning. Yat eh bena. I am speaking a language that was spoken pre-colonization, and this is a language that was taught to me through my grandparents. And the tribes that I originate from are Navajo on my maternal side and Lac du Flambeau, Band of Chippewa on my father's side in Wisconsin.
And can we have your name in English?
And my name in English is Elizabeth Bahi. So the correct pronunciation is Bahi in terms of the last name.
Thank you.
I have been here a citizen of Oregon, but also as a citizen of my tribe, the Navajo tribe, and a citizen of the United States. And in my time in Oregon, I've served as an educator at Willamette University, as the director for Native American programs, and also as a mother who has had two daughters come through the public education system here in Salem. And I speak from both perspectives as an educator of teaching predominantly non-native students who come from an array of areas across the United States, but also from here in the state of Oregon, whose parents are seventh and eighth generation Oregonians. And in the process of teaching about the residential boarding school experience, of which we have Chemawa Indian School on in the area that of Salem, what I have heard consistently across the board from students is stating that, why weren't we taught this history? Why were we not taught this history in our K through 12 curriculum? Why were we not told about these events that took place in our states? Because what I've provided has been a broad array of history and narratives that come from across in terms of different tribes, so that they can learn about how to support authentically the students that are at Chemawa Indian School through a tutoring support program that Willamette University has. And as a parent of two daughters who have come through the K through 12 system here in Salem, it is very important to have them hear about the indigenous people of this area. As is respectful, when you go into someone's home, you introduce yourself. You are part of creating a sense of community when you do that. And what I have supplemented their knowledge with is about the Oregonian tribes here, the indigenous people of this area. And it's been important for them to learn that, so that they respect who they are here, but they respect extended community members and understand how we are all contributing members of society here, and because they are also future taxpayers as well. And in terms of Senate Bill 13, it's about time. And I think that there are a number of other states here that are also understanding of that history. Washington, who is our neighbor right next door, and Montana State, and to serve as a leader in among states in the United States to provide this. I'm quite passionate about it. And I wasn't quite prepared to provide a testimonial, so thank you for including me on this. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Mm-hmm. Go ahead.
Okay. Co-Chair Monroe, Co-Chair Smith-Warner, and representatives, I would first like to acknowledge the nine sovereign nations of Oregon and all other tribal nations who traditionally used what is now known as Oregon for letting us work and do our business on their land.
And we need your name on the record.
Okay. I would also like to acknowledge the tribal people gathered today to share their words and experiences in support of Senate Bill 13. Although I am my name is Karina Wolf, and my family is from the Tuolumne Rancheria of Miwok Indians in Northern California. I am here today as a daughter and as a mother, as well as an educational administrator who serves in executive leadership in the role of Senior Director of Multiple Pathways to Graduation at Portland Public Schools. I come, as I said, as a daughter of a Miwok woman who was educated both in her local community in California as well as a boarding school experience in the 1950s. I'm also the mother of two Miwok children who, while our tribal home is in another state, are being educated in Portland Public Schools. At a time when our budgets are strained, we need to make smart investments that improve the educational outcomes of our future civic leaders. Senate Bill 13 is a smart investment for the following reasons. It holds the ability to allow accurate knowledge from local tribal nations to be cultivated and shared in a manner which respects both tribal sovereignty and tribal leadership in Oregon and throughout the United States. In the absence of current and historical multidimensional intergenerational tribal knowledge and ways of knowing, inaccurate information is currently being shared as factual to innocent and unknowing students of all races in grades pre-K through 12. Senate Bill 13 allows for a fundamental shift by promoting information on Native tribes and Native cultures to be shared statewide. Thousands of Oregon educators strive to teach well, and yet lack the content materials and indigenous framework within which to do so. Senate Bill 13 will allow accurate information to be available to educators of all school districts, rural and urban, including Portland Public Schools. We're in Oregon's largest school district, 0.3% of teachers and 0.6% of administrators, including myself, identify as Native American, according to PPS Human Resources data in November of 2016. As a result of having accurate, current, and comprehensive tribal information available to teachers and administrator colleagues in every school statewide, the burden of educating other educators on American Indian culture and sovereignty will at least in part be relieved from current Native teachers and Native administrators. Therefore, Native American professional longevity within K-12 education will be supported by Senate Bill 13. Additionally, as the senior director over the PPS district-wide reconnection services program, which works to reconnect students who have experienced disconnection from school, Native students drop out of school at higher rates than any other race year after year. When I ask students to describe what factors led to their disconnection from school, Native students often articulate not seeing themselves and their families, their tribes, in the curriculum as a loud and clear message that they and their families are not wanted in our classrooms. Lastly, as a mom, my own children experience invisibility in each and every grade through the absence of tribal knowledge of their teachers and knowledge of their classmates. As a state, Native children deserve to be respected as both, and both Native and non-Native students deserve accurate and relevant information, including the talents and strengths of tribal people from time immemorial to the present day. Senate Bill 13 provides an opportunity to correct the ills of the Indian boarding school era with accurate, tribally led, integrated Native education for all students pre-K-12. Tribal history is our history. All of us who now call this place home need comprehensive and tribal education. Please support Senate Bill 13 when it comes to a floor vote. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Okay. Rainey Lee Ritalto and Leonie Subsidiar. Or something like that.
Welcome.
Hi. I'm Rainley Ritalto. I am a non-Native in terms of being an Indian. I have lived in Oregon my entire life. I'm a banker by trade, and I'm a grandmother of seven. And growing up, the education that we had here was very minimal in terms of Native education. I had the opportunity a couple of years ago to go to one of my oldest grandson's class. He's now 15, so in his K-8 classroom setting, K-8 school, excuse me, which is Harrison Park Elementary, a very, very ethnically diverse school. They did a curriculum around the Lewis and Clark expedition, teaching them a Native history. And I got invited to their potlatch feast, which is their culmination of, their celebration at the end of this session of curriculum. And I got the opportunity to speak with many of the students in the classroom. And the thing that I quickly found out really shocked me, which is all of the students in that classroom, without exception, that I talked to, all believed that Native American people were people that lived once upon a time, but are now extinct. So I really want to focus on the cost of ignorance, because, as a state, I think it's important for all of our citizens to understand the people who are here before us, who are still here with us. And I think that, we have a rare opportunity that we have these folks among us able to give their history to teach us, because, one of the rites of passage that everyone pretty much, goes through when they graduate and go to college, then they go out and explore, or they go out after graduation, explore the world, try to learn other cultures and things. We have a very substantial culture amongst us, but their population numbers are small. So to me as a grandmother, the scary thing is here's a classroom of kids that never got corrected their misperception that these people are extinct. And now they're going into high school, soon to be going out into the world. And at what point do they actually get educated that these folks are not only not extinct, they're still all over our state? Mm-hmm. To me, that's frightening. And that's, you know, to not correct that is almost to me like creating genocide again. Mm-hmm. So I want to say, honestly, if we don't pass this, it will be shameful on all of us. This bill is probably one of the most necessary bills I've ever seen as an Oregonian. Thank and that's you. All I have to say. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Good morning, Co-Chair Monroe and Co-Chair Smith-Warner. For the record, my name is Leilani Subzalian. I want to begin by acknowledging the nine sovereign nations and all other indigenous peoples who consider this territory their homelands. I am Aleutik, a citizen of the native Chignik, native village of Chignik in Alaska. So although I'm native, I consider myself a guest here as well on these homelands. And for those reasons, I advocate so strongly for a bill like this. It's my duty as a guest to consider my citizenry here, not only to the state of Oregon, but to all the native nations here as well. So I speak as a postdoctoral scholar of Indigenous Studies and Education and soon to be assistant professor of education at the University of Oregon. I teach the pre-service teachers, future teachers, many of whom come to my classrooms knowing very little of Native people in Oregon or Native presence in really the United States. I also speak as a parent of two young Native children who attend Oregon public schools and a former student myself. So I have testified already at former meetings about the stereotypes and caricatures and dehumanization that my own children have experienced in schools. I am not interested in reiterating that. I hope that you recognize that many of us have painful experiences. That alone, I think, should be enough for this bill, which I think is a reparation for the types of damage our own students experience in schools. I want to speak instead to the fiscal ask of this bill. So the $2 million required to implement this bill is really a small amount compared to the debt that this state owes Native nations in Oregon. It pales in comparison to the 61 million acres of indigenous homelands that Oregon now considers public and private property. Or the years and years of assimilative education and educational neglect that Native students have endured in Oregon schools. I think it also pales in comparison to the millions of dollars that Native nations invest back in this state. So fully funding this bill, which really amounts to $3.68 a student, it's $1,500 a school, and it's $9,000 a district. That's a small amount. If we want to move Oregon schools to being more responsible and accountable for this legacy. My second point is that this legislation isn't just for Native students. The research in Montana and Washington has clearly pointed to the benefit and the positive impact these bills have had for Native students, but they also point to the positive impact and benefit these bills have for all students. So I want us to view this as a Native-led initiative that's not just for students, but really is about Native educators trying to improve education in the state for all our students. And I think that's an important shift in our framing. Social studies education, and I teach social studies methods courses, social studies education cannot be good social studies education without multiple perspectives, without tribal perspectives. It fundamentally would be miseducation. It would be reproducing ignorance that we've heard already. And I think the testimony that I've heard before and that elder and language educator Valerie Switzler has said repeatedly is that this is about Native nations and Native peoples trying to restore that good relationship, that good neighbor relationship, right? So this is actually an investment in Native educators trying to help all students in Oregon. And I think like you had said, the cost of ignorance is too much. It's too much. This is a small investment for us to have a really good, substantial, honest, responsible, and quality education for all students in our schools.
Thank you, ladies. Yeah, that bumper sticker that says, if you think education is expensive, wait till you find out how much ignorance costs is absolutely true. Thank you very much. We're going to back clean up with Justin and Phil. Gentlemen, it's a pleasure. You have 5 minutes between you.
Shouldn't need that much.
We'll keep it to two.
Mr. Chair, Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Justin Martin, and I'm here today on behalf of the Confederated Tribes of Grand Ronde, where I'm also a tribal member. I'm also proud to teach at Western Oregon University, Native American Politics and Policy, when we're not in legislative session. So thank you very much for your consideration of Senate Bill 13. We are here in full support. You have my tribal chairman's testimony within the record. So I'd just like to touch on one thing, and I think in my 21 years in representing the Confederated Tribes of Grand Ronde in this building, we can be very, very proud of what we've all accomplished together, whether it was the government-to-government process, putting that into statute, whether it was deletion of squaw language with Oregon geographic board names, whether it was dealing with illegally held archaeological objects, creating the tribal attendance pilot program, certifying tribal police officers to do the work of every other police officer and every other peace officer throughout Oregon, we've really done wonderful things. Senate Bill 13 is an extension of that. I'm proud that Grand Ronde has already instituted this with the Willamina School District. We also are offering this in 10 other districts throughout the state. So I guess we just come here today to, one, say thank you, and two, let's continue this wonderful tradition that we have here in Oregon. Thank you.
Thanks, Justin. Phil?
Good morning. For the record, my name is Phil Donovan, here on behalf of the Confederated Tribes of the Umatilla Indian Reservation. We've submitted a written testimony in support of Senate Bill 13 from Modesta Minthorn, who testified to the Senate Education Committee. Just a couple of quick thoughts. One, I can personally attest to the thoughtfulness that was put into development of this legislation. I was able to participate in the education government-to-government cluster meeting where they sat down with representatives from Montana and Washington and learned from their experiences, you know, in Montana. They did it first. They required the curriculum, but they didn't develop it. And then Washington came along and they said they did it next. They required the curriculum and they created the curriculum, but then they didn't have any plan for implementation. So what Cindy outlined to you about the 1-2-3 steps is really a facet of that. The last point is just what Modesta's testimony speaks to, which is this is about improving educational outcomes. Creation of this culturally relevant testimony is going to help Native students learn, achieve your goal of seeing higher graduation rates. And for non-Indian students, there's a tremendous benefit in learning about these sovereign nations, how they operate, why they operate the way that they do. So with that, I'll close. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Any final questions? Thanks, guys. Appreciate it. I'm sure we'll be working this bill as soon as the big co-chairs give us the go-ahead.
Appreciate that, Mr. Chair.
Thank you.
Doug, anything for the good of the order?
There should be a meeting tomorrow. Watch your emails. We'll send an email out. I'm still trying to figure out what bills have been approved and amendments and everything else. So,
okay. We will see you all tomorrow. We're adjourned.